Okay. Good questions. Okay, probably one. Interesting. Hi, John. Why do the Thai monks shave their eyebrows? You notice? Yes, we are eyebrowless. It's more of a historical, and now it's just traditional. Apparently, I was told that in the 1800s, Thailand and Burma would have a war against each other. They would go over and kind of raid each other's kind of place. And so their Thai and Burma was at war. And apparently, the Burmese sent over lots of spies to find out what's happening in Thailand. And some of them posing as monks. And then, of course, word got back to the Thai king at that time that there were spies in the Sangha. And he had to think of something to find out who the spies were, right? So then he conferred with his generals and wise counselors. And they came up with the idea that, yes, we should ask other monks to shave the eyebrow. The reason being, as soon as, you know, so once everybody shaves their eyebrow, all the Thai monks, so when the Burmese spy go back to the country, and, you know, the king would send his spies over there to see which ones of the Burmese coming back from Thailand that eyebrowless, right? And they know, those are the spies. And then, so that's how it started, and now we've been shaving our eyebrows ever since. And yes, some people complain, we're in the West, we're not in Thailand anymore. Couldn't we just leave the eyebrow? I think when I was told that, when I was in Perth, that you know, out of respect for Ajahn Chah, who shaved his eyebrow, Ajahn Brahm kept his eyebrow. So myself, just following my teacher, out of respect for Ajahn Brahm, and Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Palim, I shaved my eyebrow. Not the end of the world. It's more another act of giving up, surrendering. You know, I don't make the rules, I just follow them. Rubbing a bit of sense of self. Because we do identify quite a bit with our eyebrow. You know, this. Yeah. Any questions or comments? Okay, what are some techniques that can be used during meditation for a very wandering, fantasizing mind? I'll read the whole question. Always making up fake conversation with yourself, with other people, in fake situations. As soon as I'm aware of it, before I know, it starts again. Yes, this is very normal. We all have an active mind. And then when you see, and that's why we're, you know, constantly on social media and on the internet. And if you spend the whole week and lots of time being very active, when you come to a quiet place, you don't need music. You don't need the computer. The mind will happily make up things for it to entertain itself with fake conversation, fake situation. Yeah. One is to really accept it's normal. There's nothing wrong with you. Everybody does it. We all live in our little digital world. But to bring some awareness around it. So the suggestion is let's just, you know, do some mantra. You know, peace, here and now. Where am I in the body? Anything just to bring your mind back to the present moment, back into the body. The other one, I encourage people just to stay in the body. Be aware of your posture. Be aware of, you know, how much space you're taking up in the body. Be aware of the tension in different areas of your body, shoulders, jawline, the hands. Yeah, I think you can only feel your body in the present moment. You don't know what the body feels like yesterday. You don't know what it's going to feel like tomorrow. So the ability just to stay in the body, to connect with the body throughout the day is a great way to cut that conversation, the fantasy short. Yeah. And as mindfulness increases, you'll find that it just naturally, this conversation, the fantasy, starts to fade away on its own. Yeah. Meditation, remember, is the a skill in focusing. You focus what's in your center. Whatever you focus on, that becomes the center of your screen. Everything else just floats around the edge. And the more you focus, like watching TV, you only see, you know, what's in the middle of the screen. Everything around the screen. When you go to a movie, you don't know what kind of curtains they have, what's around. And when you look at the TV, you don't know what's around the TV. Same with the focusing. You focus in the middle, everything is around, eventually fade away. initially you can, you know, kind of vaguely aware of the conversations or the things kind of floating around the screen of your consciousness. But once mindfulness zeroes in for any length of time, the edges fade away naturally. Yeah. Make sense? Questions or comments? For that. Okay. I feel the breath prominently on my left nostril. However, sometimes I feel the pulse more prominently at the tip of my nose. What should I observe? My question first is initially, observe the breath wherever is kind of the most prominent, most kind of easy. But if it shifts around, then try to stick with one point and see what happens. If your left nostril is very clear, then stay with that most of the time. Even if it shifts to other places, just stay with the left nostril. After a while, the mind will get used to it and you'll feel it more clearly, become more sensitive around that area. Yeah, remember, the mind is a powerful tool. Whatever it focuses on, that thing becomes more clear, more sensitive, that area. Yeah. But generally, the way that I'm going to learn and practice and the way that I was taught, it's not so important where you watch the breath. As long as you know it's an in-breath, as long as you know it's an out-breath. And then once you have that basis, then you try to follow the in-breath all the way from the beginning, the middle, and the end, all the way to the slight turns. It turns to from an out-breath to an in-breath again. All the way to the end, pause, turns, all the way. As long as you're aware of the breath continuously from the beginning to the end, it doesn't really matter where you look, you watch it. Okay. Make sense? But I know that different teachers says, you know, you got to tip the nose, your nostril, the abdomen, rise and fall, rise and fall. I found that, a different time, I've watched it at the different places as those. But I found that it's not so important where I watch the breath, as long as the quality of the awareness is bright and clear and precise. Yeah, that's really matter. Okay. And we have the meat-eating question. Okay, two questions. If the Buddha taught us to refrain from killing any living sentient being, how can Buddhists justify eating meat or fish or eggs or dairy? We may not have killed the animal ourselves, but we have paid someone else to do it for us. In the modern world, male chicks are useless to the egg industry and are grounded up alive a day 1 to 2 of age. How can we justify eating eggs? Male calves are a byproduct of the dairy product and also kill. Okay, this is a different question. I read question number 2. As Buddhists, we are taught to have compassion for everyone and to show tolerance and acceptance. However, if a friend or acquaintance brings constant negativity into our lives, are we justified in walking away from them to preserve our own peace of mind? Or should we show relentless compassion and guide them toward a more positive, compassionate life? And the first one on the on the eating meat and, you know, how can we justify that? I think as a, you probably kind of have some understanding, the Buddha started out as a mendicant, you know, kind of, priest walking around and, you know, just kind of getting food offered to him in India at different times. And obviously, it still happens in traditional Buddhist country, Thailand, and Burma, and Laos, and Sri Lanka, that people would stand in front of the houses, and the monk would go open the bowl, and they would share a bit of what they cooked for themselves. And yeah, so they were vegetarian, they were giving them vegetarian food, and they weren't, they were giving them that as well. So we, you know, they would accept whatever you know, different people cooked for themselves. And as Buddhism moves to different areas of the world, and then that's where it evolved. That a lot of monasteries stopped doing, a lot of monks don't go on that traditional alms route. They start to, you know, and then maybe they feel that it was Buddhism was not so well accepted in other areas like China and Japan. So they start to stay in monastery more. And it was supported by the royal family, who says, you know, we don't think it's very polite for monks to go begging. We think you stay in the monastery and we'll just give you lots of food. And so if you start cooking your own food, then you would have more control over what kind of diet you can have. Yeah. In terms of Buddhist kind of eating meat, I think it's an individual decision that each and everyone can make themselves. You know, how do you justify kind of, you know, the death of living beings? But keep in mind that we make karma all throughout the day, not just when we're eating. Yeah. So that, you know, how we think, mental karma, what we say, what we do. So if you can be a vegetarian without feeling, you know, kind of irritated, angry at people who aren't vegetarian, then it's a great thing to practice. But sometimes, you know, we get too obsessed with our dietary requirements, where you can't, you know, go out to dinner without, you know, interrogating the waiter or your friend what ingredients go into the dinner, whether it's completely vegan or not. Then yeah, just keep that in mind. That is, you know, about cultivating wholesome state of mind, and it's a balance. So whatever is, you know, is convenient, allowing you to cultivate wholesome state of mind of acceptance, embracing, then it's fine. Yeah. But it veers into, you know, being irritated, being annoyed that people aren't vegetarian, a sense of righteous indignation, or a sense of anxiety about what you eat, you know, what goes into it. You find that you're consumed by that kind of emotional stuff regarding food, then you can ask, is it really worth it? Yeah. So the ability is just to adapt, to change the situation. Sure, when you can, you do want to practice compassion and acceptance. Yeah. Does that make sense? Comments? Rebuttals? Okay, second bit. About compassion for everyone and short tolerance. Yeah. I just remember, someone reminded me of this short story about metta, compassion, acceptance. Story goes something like this. You might have read it in a certain book. Story goes like, there's five monks living in a cave, very beautiful, secluded cave, deep into the Thai mountains, and no one could find. They were living happily together, subsisting on alms food, practicing together, blending like milk and water. Things couldn't be better, on the highway to Nirvana almost. And then one day, a bunch of thieves and robbers came in and discovered this cave. And they were running, they were being pursued by the government forces looking after them. So they found this great secluded cave that they could hang out in. And then, but they have also these monks here. So they wanted to do something to show the monks that they are serious, that, you know, the monks should not dope on them. That way they can stay for a long, long time. So they went to the abbot and they said, to make an example that we're really serious, and we don't want you guys to tell on the king and the government forces that we're hiding here. We're going to make an example of one monk. We're going to kill one monk of you five. To show that anybody tells on us, they're dead. So, but you know what? We don't care which monk it is. You're all the same to us. Bald, useless, don't do anything anyway. We're going to kill one monk. But since you're the abbot, you choose one. Which one do you choose? So, we have five monks, right? The abbot, his best friend, second monk. The third one is, no, the abbot, the second monk, which is Yakaji's best friend. The other one is a useless monk. Nice guy, but can't do anything right, can't chant, can't meditate, can't work. But it's a nice guy, but useless monk. The third one is a sick monk, right? He's so sick, he's going to die anytime anyway, right? So that's the fourth monk, sick monk. The fifth is an old monk. He's also on his way out. He's so old, falls over, he's dead. So those are the five. And then the sixth, there's six guys. One more is his enemy. This is the sixth monk is the enemy of the abbot. Not really enemy, but they just never got along, you know. Abbot says, you know, right, guys is left. High, is just low. So they never got along. They always kind of had arguments, but they still kind of, you know, stay together and practice. But, you know, just little things. So this, the guy always irritated the abbot, right? So you have six monks in the cave. Which one should the abbot choose? First one is himself. Second is his best friend. Third is a useless monk. He can't do anything anyway. Fourth, sick monk. He's going to die. Old monk's going to die. Or his enemy. Perfect chance to get rid of his enemy, right? He can practice in peace. So which one should he choose?
Himself.
Himself? Yeah, I know. People always say that. Why is he so mean? Why himself? He's the wise one. He should know. He should lead the community. Now, sometimes we do get that. We like, you know, oh, this idea of Christian condition of sacrificing ourselves for the good of others. Now, very close, but that isn't it either. Abbot. Having considered it for a few hours, he comes to a conclusion. He can't decide anyone. And he explained the reason why he can't decide to kill which one. Because his deep practice of metta, of loving kindness, acceptance, that all these monks are one and the same to him. He can't decide. Obviously, he loved himself as much as he loved the other five. He loved his best friend, of course he loved his best friend because they got along really well, as much as himself. The useless monk, he also loved the useless monk as much as himself. No more, no less, right? Oh, sick, it's the same. The ability to accept, to embrace, to see the value of everything and everybody. Same with his enemy. Even this guy really annoys him. Every day he says something silly. Every day he gets under his skin. But even so, he still has kindness, acceptance, and love for his enemy. And yes, you can say, well, why don't he just kill himself? But that's also, he also have metta, kindness towards himself as well, because he's also a being. So when he explained his reasoning for why he can't choose any of the monks based on metta, based on his Buddhist concept of loving kindness, of unconditional love, unbounded to ourselves as well as to others. The brother was so impressed, they threw their knives away and became monks. So that's the idea of metta, right? Remember, sometimes we go into the world and we have this idea that I'm going to give up my happiness for other people's happiness. But really, once you start to practice, unless you yourself have a sense of well-being, unless you yourself, you know, are happy, it's hard to make anybody else happy, truly. Yeah. When we're suffering, you know, our suffering is right here. It blocks everything. And generally, and you can see that in other people. People suffering don't care about others because they're consumed by their own suffering. So sometimes they say things, do things that are not so nice. But that's okay because you understand. Yeah, when you suffer, when you're in a painful, you have chronic pain, experiencing, you know, kind of mental pain, it's hard to be aware of others around you. Yeah. So in terms of, you know, looking after your friend, you know, whether we can, it's, you have to understand, you know, where you're at in terms of your practice. You can do, you know, guide your friends towards more positive outlook for more, you know, kind of a better way. And you can, it doesn't affect your own sense of well-being. Yes. Otherwise, yeah, have the wisdom to know where you're at. If interacting, being around this person will always bring up negative state of mind, bring up tension, anxieties, then yeah, wisdom says, you know, man, you still care for this person, still appreciate them, but not at this time. You make sure that, you know, at this interaction, it's where you practice equanimity. Yes, I love you, but we love you at a distance for the time being. You understand that you want to help them, but they're not ready. You're not ready. You're not in a position to help yet. Yeah. So it takes wisdom. So compassion always have to be kind of coupled with wisdom to be really effective. Yeah. Sometimes people have too much compassion. I suffer. I read about the, you know, the injustices, the violence in the newspaper. It gets me really depressed. That's compassion without wisdom. Wisdom says, you know, yeah, people are heir to their own karma. People will do silly things. It's just the way the world is. There's lots of violence, injustice. It's not fair. But things are kind of rotate, move, evolve based on causes and conditions. And all we have to do is, yeah, to accept that. But it doesn't have to depress us, have to make us sad. You know, during the time of the Buddha, there was plenty of violence and injustice. It wasn't a perfect world back then either. But through his wisdom and compassion, he relate to it in a wise and compassionate way. Right? So it's how you relate to the world, that whether the world is perfect or not. How you relate to your loved ones, your situation. Yeah. So always, you know, you can always accept reality as it is. Always accept the situation and learn from it. It can't be any other way. Sometimes we indulge in, you know, it shouldn't be this way, it should be that way. We should have world peace, we should love everybody. It's a nice idea. But the world will never have world peace. There'll always be war, really. But that's okay, it doesn't mean we can't help people around us. We can't be a positive influence in the world. We can be. We can do things to change. But it starts with, you know, understanding ourselves, starts with training the mind, being at peace ourselves, training the mind to be more calm, more clear, more bright, and learn to accept ourselves first. Yeah. So compassion extends both ways. And knowing, you know, it's always a balance. Yeah, so always, when you look after yourself, you look after the others as well. Because when you're happy, that positive energy radiates outward, naturally. When you're unhappy, annoyed, depressed, you can't save the world either. Even though no matter, it's a great idea. Yeah. So keep that in mind when as we practice compassion, always coupled with wisdom. Yeah. Questions or comments? And that's what you take, you know, like an example of Action Chan. Only studied 4 years of education, went up to the forest for about 15, 20 years, meditated, looked like a selfish kind of thing, not looking after his family. But through his deep wisdom, through, you know, his deep practice, he became a great teacher when he emerged from the forest. And he had a huge influence on, you know, thousands and thousands of, you know, people that came across with him. And that's the legacy of 300 branch monasteries, thousands of monks, a million people showed up to his funeral because they, you know, they had so benefited so much from his teaching and his influence. And that's the influence of one person who, yes, focused on the practice for a period of time. And the contrast of that, you have these world leaders, powerful people, presidents of U.S. When they go out of office, nobody remembers them. Yeah. So we want to be, you know, having an effect in the world, really. Train the mind. Clarify the mind first. And see what happens. Questions, comments? Okay, so that is it. And which leads me to tonight's Dhamma talk. And yeah, so we've kind of spent the last roughly 24 hours sitting in quiet monastery, learning to meditate. We're trying to focus the mind. And yeah, and it's interesting, you know, what things to come up with. And hopefully you kind of get the sense of it yourself. We want to be peaceful, want to be still. When we come here, nothing to do really. Organize wonderful food for you. beautiful accommodations, and yet the mind doesn't want to become still. Why not? You're wondering. Why doesn't my mind become still and happy? I don't have to do anything. Right. Well, the first answer is, firstly, it's not your fault, in case you're wondering that you're just crazy. A crazy mind, you have a crazy mind. No, it's not your fault, that's normal. The mind is like this, and that's the reason why, you know, we have quiet places like monastery and retreat center. It's like a laboratory for you to see this mind and body of yours. Understand, what is this thing that I wake up with and go to sleep with? From the moment I'm born to the moment I'm dying, what is this thing? Yeah. The ability, and then meditation is not always necessary to, you know, to be absorbed into an object, but really to understand yourself more. To see, when you sit quietly, trying to focus on the breath, where does the mind go? Past, future, fantasy, situations, memories, painful ones, happy ones. Wherever you go to, wherever that takes you away from the present moment, wherever it takes you away from the breath, that is what you attach to. That is what you long for. That is what you identify with. Okay. So just knowing that much is a great thing. Instead of saying, oh, it's a stupid mind, why doesn't it go in the breath? Well, you know, where does it go? Yeah. It's practice meditation, the ability to understand yourself, understand reality more. So, and that's why I tell people, there's no such thing as a bad meditation. You have a restless mind, great. You can learn what's it like to have a restless mind. Where does it go? What thing it goes to? How does it feel? What's the system express itself in the body? You have a peaceful sit, the mind's absorbed, mind is bright, body is light. You know what peace feels like as well. Yeah. It's really to learn from nature, to learn in the present moment. It's the same skills that we need to like to live in a, you know, productive life. So it's not always about sitting with your eyes closed, blanking out reality. You know, so much more than that. Just it's this understanding. Also cultivating great spiritual qualities of patient endurance. Just being with whatever's happening. Not going somewhere else. So I was telling you, you know, like earlier with the guided meditation. Yeah. The ability to wait in the moment. And see what comes. To wait for the breath to come to you. Instead of reaching out, grabbing it, squeezing it, throttling it until you become absorbed with it. And just to sit and wait. What sounds come, stay and go away. Memories, thoughts come and go. It's just to sit and wait and watch. And learn from your experience. And once the mind starts to settle down, you can see for yourself, you know, what peace feels like, what stillness feels like. Yeah, it's an amazing experience, really. Once the mind starts to settle down, there's a brightness, a clarity, an energy that you have experienced before. And that's kind of the beauty of the teaching of the Buddha and the Dhamma. It's that the simple exercises, but something each and every one of us can do for ourselves. We have the tools, really, to transcend our own suffering. For something that we have to focus, to train the mind. It doesn't happen naturally. And those of you who may know, may not know, there are the five kind of distractions in the mind, five forces in the mind. There's always there. It's desires, wanting things to your liking. And there's ill will. You know, wanting to get rid of things. There's two main forces in the mind. Wanting something, wanting to get rid of something. Either fantasize about the perfect situation you can be at. Oh, why am I going to this treaded monastery? It's freezing here. Why don't I have some floor heating? That'd be really nice to have some floor heating one of these days. Maybe I'll put that suggestion box. next time. Or whatever. So I send that one, oh, I think, oh, still cold. I'll keep at home in my own jacuzzi. Maybe somewhere else, much, much more nicer. Right? Wanting and not, and wanting to get rid of things. Those are the main forces in the mind that takes you from the present moment. The other one are restlessness. That's how I mentioned. Minds that doesn't like, really. We say we like peace, but some part of us likes peace. The other parts, quite happy, entertaining with other things, with activities, and things to think about, imaginary situations to work through, imagination, people to interact with. So that's restlessness. Third is, you see, quite clearly, early morning sitting, the gazing, the never gazing posture that someone still. I probably did a fair amount of that this morning as well. I did an all-night sit. It's sloth and torpor. Kind of rocking back and forth. And that's also normal. And you have the mental experience. And the way I looked at it is that we live in a very fast-moving world. So we constantly do it. And then when you're sitting with your eyes closed, some part of your brain says, or your mind says, you know, oh, must be sleep time. Where else are you sitting still, eyes closed, and not talking? And then your body, your mind just turns itself up. So it takes time to get used to the subtlety of sitting with eyes closed, but being awake and aware at the same time. Yeah. So sloth and torpor is also a normal experience. And then you have kind of liking, disliking, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. Doubt that, you know, why am I sitting here? Am I wasting my time sitting, doing nothing? I could be cleaning the house, doing some spring cleaning. I could be going on a nice holiday or something. I'm stuck here doing eyes closed, doing nothing. I think it's a waste of time. I think these Buddhists are lazy. That's why they invent this meditation business. So sitting here with your eyes closed and doing nothing. It sounds like there's so much more to do with the world. Why don't we change the world to make it a more interesting place? Instead of with your eyes closed and do nothing. So doubt comes up. Well, doubt could be, you know, oh, maybe I'm not watching properly. Why is my mind not settling down? Maybe I don't have what it takes. Maybe everybody here is getting into deep absorption states. It's just me, confused, crazy one, that's sitting here with mind all over the place. I must be the only crazy one with a chattering mind. No, it's not true. Everybody has a chattering mind. Yeah, so doubt comes up. So those are the five natural states of the mind, you say, the state of an untrained mind. Unless you're fully enlightened, these come up at different times. But that once we understand, you've heard it teaching before, you understand, yeah. When you see these, you understand, oh, these are that. It's not your fault. These are natural forces when the mind is not trained. And we apply different antidotes to overcome these negative mental states. And that's where intelligence, wisdom comes in. You know, get to know your hindrances, which one comes to visit you the most. They're not your enemy, they're your friend. They're always there. Understand them. Once you understand them, they fade away. And that's the power of the wisdom teaching. But until then, they'll come and visit you over and over again. So over the next couple of days, just sit and wait and learn about your five friends that visit you from time to time. What is it? How do they come? How does it feel in the body to have desire? What does it feel like to be irritated? Where does it express itself? The chest, tightening of the chest, kind of a tiredness, a bit of too much energy, kind of rocking back and forth. Or a bit of, you know, kind of, yeah. How does doubt, what is doubt? How does the doubt express itself to you? Yes, it's just the understanding. And it's true. And this beauty of wisdom. When you have wisdom, there is no problem. The problem disappears by itself. So this path is a path, yes, compassion, but compassion with a large dose of wisdom, understanding, you know, how your mind works, understand who you are. What things do you dream about? What things you long for? When you're sitting here, especially watching the breath. Not that it's your fault, Not that you're a bad meditator, but yeah, where does it go? This thing, you have to understand where the mind is, what stores it goes to. It's like when you go to the shopping mall, right? The shopping mall, there's like hundreds of stores. But you have mindfulness, you'll say that we go to the same stores pretty much every weekend. Same with the shopping in the grocery store. We go to the same aisle day in, day out, look at certain things. And that's how the mind works itself. It just has these certain grooves it goes through. So after a while you understand, yeah. But those grooves are trainable, are resettable, and malleable. But it does take some training to steer them. So understanding of the mind, you think you have a negative mind, you can retrain it slowly. Think steering the mind towards positive mental states, towards acceptance, forgiveness, more patience, allowing things to be, letting go, learning. Feel where you have a relaxed mind, then arouse the energy, focusing energy, arousing energy, maintaining it, increasing it. But first and foremost, just really just step back and to learn. And not to make a self out of it. But it's your problem. You and you're lazy, confused, crazy, whatever. Not true. These are natural conditions of the mind. And we all have it at different times. Yeah, so our task is just to learn our own unique strengths and weaknesses. And to train. Yeah. Because, you know, at the end of the day, what else is there to do on this earth, really? The body, that, you know, only goes one way. You don't get stronger, more healthy when you get 60 or 70, right? Your achievement, your relationship, your family, your loved ones. Yes, they're wonderful, but eventually, they go their separate ways. They have their own families. Relationship ends. Things become, you know, changes all the time. Yeah. So as we learn to kind of train the mind, we have this increased ability to adapt. Adaptability, sense says, is the key to happiness. It's the holding on, the disdain, freezing, not changing, creating a lot of suffering. So those big trees, gum trees you see in the forest. Little wind comes, they fall over. But this little bamboo that you see around the monastery, that's my excuse for planting bamboos everywhere, even though it's non-native. Those bamboos bend with the wind. So they don't. Have you ever seen any clump of bamboo that falls over from a big storm? No, because they bend. Yeah, the same with the mind. Saying with yourself, learn to bend, to change with the ever-evolving world around us. There's a world change in a faster pace in order to, you know, to maintain our sanity, maintain a sense of balance. You have to be able to have the ability to change as well, to adapt, to move. And that comes from understanding, comes from acceptance, comes from wisdom. It is something that each and every one of us can train for. It doesn't come naturally, but you can train. It's like a muscles, the mental qualities. It's like a muscle that we can train for. So that's a little talk I offered you this evening. First, the five distractions in the mind. Liking, disliking, doubt, restlessness, and sloth and torpor. So encourage. Spend the next few days, but a short time, but to learn about yourself. Who you, you know, what is it you take yourself to be? Who's this person inside? When you're not talking, interacting with other people, when you're quiet, not having to think and solve. Who's this person? Yeah. And hopefully, through stillness, through clarity, we learn to, you know, to transcend. We learn to transcend the suffering. We learn to understand who we are, or understand where is it that we make problems for ourselves and others? Where is it that we suffer? Yeah. And through transcending our own suffering, our own issues, we can bring understanding, love, and clarity to the people around us. Yeah. So it's not just for ourselves that we practice, it's for the whole entire world that we practice. So I'll leave that for you tonight. Okay, so we can continue sitting or call it night. Bow together.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivade. Vakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Dhammasam. Supatipanno bhagavato asavaka sangho sangha.